The following talk was given at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on January 21st, 2024. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Morning, everyone.
Morning.
As most of you know, I'm Steve Matuszek, the head teacher here at Dharma Field, and I'm happy to introduce our guest speaker this morning, Ben Connolly. Ben is the assistant guiding teacher at Minnesota Zen Meditation Center over on Bede Mikaska, which is just a stone's throw away if you've got a really good arm. So Ben started practicing at MZMC in 2001, was ordained in 2005, and received Dharma transmission from Tim Burkett in 2015. In addition to being a teacher at Minnesota Zen Center, he teaches around the community as well, both mindfulness and working with social and environmental justice issues. And he's a prolific author, so he does quite a bit. He has 4 books to his credit, 3 of which he'll be selling downstairs and signing copies of. And today's talk is from his most recent book, which was published in 2022, Vasubandhu's 3 Natures. So, without further ado, Ben.
Thanks, Steve. Oh, thank you so much. How sweet to be here. I just want to look around and see all the faces of dear friends, people I've known for a long time, maybe some people I've never met. I don't get over here very much. And then I have FOMO, fear of missing out. Just knowing, you know, all the beautiful practice that happens here has been happening for years, and I just feel really grateful to be welcomed here this morning. And I do feel like I'm part of this community. So we got our sibling sanghas. So I think I'll just jump in to the topic, which is ice skating. That's not true. I'm not jumping into the topic. Do you know people are ice skating on Bede Mikaska and on Lake of the Isles? You know, just to be recognized that, you know, I might walk outside and be like, ah, it's cold. I can't go outside. Miserable, grumpy. And, you know, to look out the window of our Zen Center and just see people, their response to the situation is to just do something so beautiful and graceful. And that is in deep relationship to the particular conditions of nature right now. It's rare that we can skate on these lakes. People showing something beautiful about how to be. Okay, so now really, I'm going to talk about Vasubandhu's 3 natures. So Vasubandhu is probably about a 5th century Indian monk. Very influential figure. So Vasubandhu is in all Zen lineages. When we chant the names of the ancestors at our Zen Center, as they do at many places, when you get to the name of Vasubandhu, the priest does a full bow, as they do for about 8 of the most influential ancestors. Vasubandhu is considered one of the 6 ornaments of Tibetan Buddhism, and one of the 5 great ancestors of the Jodo Shinshu Pure Land tradition. So in many different Buddhist traditions, Vasubandhu is considered really pretty wonderful. Also, he's incredibly obscure. So I can't tell you how many people I know when I say I write books about Vasubandhu. They just go, what are you doing and why? So hopefully this talk will give you something about the why. So Vasubandhu is associated with kind of early Buddhist psychology, you could say, the Abhidharma tradition. And then later in life, became more associated with Mahayana Buddhism, and in particular with a movement in Mahayana called Yogacara, which means yoga practice. So Yogacara is really about integrating early Buddhist psychology with the Mahayana emphasis on collective liberation and the immediate availability of realization and awakeness in simple terms. So these two modes of practice are sometimes considered quite separate. So when Vasubandhu was alive, there was a lot of debating about which one is better or correct. And guess what? There still is. How wonderful. So early Buddhist psychology, the Abhidharma tradition, which is kind of, more closely related to what you might think of as Theravada Buddhism or Vipassana tradition, involves slowly and meticulously developing awareness of particular elements of your experience. So becoming aware of the sensations in the body, the particularities of breathing, and then becoming aware of feelings, whether there's a negative, positive, or neutral tone to the experience you're having. Noticing whether there is desire or aversion in experiencing. Noticing whether there is a lack of energy or an excess. Noticing whether the mind is concentrated and having terms. So you like learn the list of things you're trying to identify and then you notice them. So you might think as a Zen person, that sounds very tiresome. And in fact, many Zen people, including me, have looked at the giant lists of things you should notice in early Buddhist psychology and thought, oh no, I don't need more of that kind of thing in my life. But it can be really useful. It can be very useful to notice what's going on, in particular with your emotions, which tend to govern a huge amount of human conduct. And I will say, if the whole point of Buddhism is to alleviate suffering, it seems like our emotions are going to have to matter to us. But, there's a critique of this early Buddhist model because it's focused on doing that in order to attain nirvana, which starts to look like a kind of a heroic personal thing where it's like, oh, I'll attain nirvana and good luck everyone else. Just go out in the woods and find my peace. So we have a Mahayana movement that says we need a social model for liberation and for how this practice can work so that liberation can be viewed collectively. And so this is kind of like where Yogacara is coming from. So Thich Nhat Hanh, one of the main reasons I teach Vasubandhu and spend so much time with the material, learning it, trying to understand it, practice it, transmit it, is because it's really the foundation of Thich Nhat Hanh's movement and vision of engaged Buddhism. So I said this for a long time, and I've said it so many times that I thought maybe I just made it up. But I have talked to quite a few people who study with Thay, and they said, yeah, that sounds accurate. And then I had an exciting experience, which is I was doing a workshop 2 years ago on this Three Natures at Union Theological Seminary in New York. And when I arrived, one of the students said, did you know that Thich Nhat Hanh got a master's degree here in 1962? And I said, no. And he said, did you know his master's thesis was on Yogacara and is in the library? And I said, no, but I would like to be that. Because I'm a nerd, in case you're not picking up on it yet. So anyway, this idea that Buddhism can give us a way where we can simultaneously fully care for ourselves and the conditions of our own lives while engaging constantly in the possibility of everyone being free from suffering is really inspiring to me. And this is really the kind of the underpinning of the Yogacara worldview. So the three natures are basically they're the philosophy, the most philosophical component, the philosophical underpinning of Yogacara. So in my first book on Yogacara, Inside Vasubandhu's Yogacara, when I get to the section, two-thirds of the way through on the three natures, I said, this is what the part where you might end up putting the book down. Because some people don't really like philosophy. However, I've been around Dharma field enough to know that might not be you. So the three natures. We could say are three aspects of anything you think is a thing. So sometimes they're called the three characteristics. So the claim that this tradition is making that each thing has these three natures or is of these three natures or has these three characteristics. And the three natures are the imaginary nature, the dependent nature, and the complete realized nature. These are various translated by other people, but I'm not going to get into that today. So each thing that you think is a thing, like yourself or the wall or climate change or trees or birds or sadness, is imaginary, it's dependent, and it's of complete realized nature. So the imaginary nature of things is what you think they are. The dependent nature of things is that they appear as they do, dependent on other conditions. And the complete realized nature is that they are not what you think they are. So pretty simple. Around some Buddhist circles, this will come across as commonplace and normal way of looking at things. But for many people, it is an extremely strange, challenging, and sometimes alarming way of looking at things. Now, what we'll see is the reason that we want to say things are imaginary is to understand why we have power and why liberation is possible. So Yogacara really wants to address the question of why, if everything is empty of separate existence, what you do matters. And this is answered in various ways in other traditions, but they wanted to emphasize answering this question. So I think I'm going to read a little passage from the book, from the introduction about these three natures. Every aspect of what we would conventionally call experience is of these three natures. Sights, sounds, smells, tastes, physical sensations, thoughts, emotions, and our sense of being a self. For example, the cobalt blue car that I can see outside my window is of an imaginary nature. Whatever I'm experiencing it to be right now, a memory, as I'm currently looking at letters on a screen, or now, as I turn my head to look at it again, whatever I think it to be is a construction of habits of consciousness and imagination. I suspect it will take some time for you to consider this a reasonable or useful claim, and so, dear reader, that's why I'm writing this book. That car is also of a dependent nature. Countless conditions that are not the car create the appearance of a car. Reflected sunlight, ocular nerves, supply chain software, oil refineries, the desire for wealth, and so on. This car is also of complete realized nature. It isn't what I think it is. Recognizing that things aren't what you think they are can radically disarm the patterns of your mind that cause you to suffer and cause suffering. For example, in order to see the car in my normal way, I am usually ignorant of or ignore a vast array of conditions on which the appearance of the car depends, conditions that cause suffering in this time of climate crisis. These teachings are to help us move beyond this kind of ignorance. The so-called knowledge that white people are inherently superior to black people and the purported fact that race exists as a biological phenomenon were confirmed by 19th century scientific experiments, which have since been disproven. This caused and causes incalculable harm. This so-called knowledge is imaginary. It arises from conditions, and its complete realized nature is that it is not real. And yet millions of people thought and still think it is true. Although many of us do not, the impacts of the view are pervasive. It affects where people live, the jobs we have, the wealth we inherit, our access to education, and so much more. They are alive in how I experience the world. This teaching is here so we may continually grow in our capacity to end and transform harmful patterns of which we are often unaware. By learning to see the three natures of the ideas that maintain harmful systems, we open a way for liberation. The three natures can be misapplied and easily misunderstood. Understanding the imaginary nature invites humility, not grandiosity. It affirms agency. It does not deny experiences. Understanding the dependent nature affirms kinship with all things. it does not deny differences or boundaries. Understanding the complete realized nature brings faith, compassion, and joy. It does not deny suffering. The three natures provide medicine for our ongoing daily sufferings, no matter how small. So, just to be clear, when talking about this kind of material or any of the related material in Buddhism, which is about how things are empty of separate existence, it is very easy to sound like you're denying the importance of what you're addressing, which is not helpful for a lot of people. So, you know, in the case, for example, I use race as an example here, it's clear that race impacts people's lives. I mean, it would be really hard to deny that. And yet, it's not a real thing. It's a recent social construct, and at some point probably won't be here, hopefully before humans die out, in my opinion. Anyway, so the imaginary nature is, you know, when we perceive a thing as having characteristics or distinctness from other things, those characteristics and its distinctness are constructed by the patterns of our consciousness. That's the claim of this tradition. This, by the way, really, I'm not going to spend any time on this. It's very similar to what a lot of cognitive scientists and a lot of neuroscience is suggesting at this time, although it's not identical. But there are substantial commonalities, which I address a little bit in the book. But anyway, we're imagining. So when I say, oh, things are in imaginary nature, the most common way that is used in medicine in Buddhism is to help us go, oh, that's right, I don't have to freak out about this. So, you know, you're like, I'm really mad because, you know, you said that mean thing to me. You know, that's okay. Sometimes we're mad, but sometimes we could just be like, oh, I don't have to be mad. I made this dynamic the way I made it. And I can also not make it that way. And I can just be like, oh, you're probably upset. Maybe I want to try and understand you. So by seeing things as imaginary, sometimes we can immediately drop the way we're looking at it that is causing us to suffer and is likely to cause us to act in a way that causes other people to suffer. But by calling things imaginary and by emphasizing that things are imagined in this way, Yogacara tradition wants to emphasize that we're making the world. This is about power. Buddha's message was relentless that you have the capacity to engage in liberation. Constantly meeting people who appear powerless or are caught in some kind of way of looking at things and just saying, you can wake up. So when we realize it's like what we do creates the world we live in, that's bringing us back to this position of agency. So the way this is explained in this tradition is through karma. So another way of thinking about Yogacara is they really wanted to reclaim karma from the fear, I think, that was happening that maybe the doctrine of emptiness would make karma meaningless. And in Buddhist thought, karma is why things matter. Basically, they don't have a materialist view of what makes human suffering come and go. They were saying for a long time that what makes our suffering happen is the way we're thinking about things, the way we're acting, and the way we feel. Radically emphasizing agency. So the most common way to talk about the way our imaginary experience, our experience, which is the same as imagination, like what we experience, this is imaginary, is through our actions. That's what karma means. So the common metaphor we use in the Yogacara tradition is that of planting seeds. So every cognitive, emotional, or physical act, which includes speech, so sometimes we say body, speech, and mind, but I'm going to say cognitive, emotional, and physical act, plants a seed that will produce a similar result at some time. Teachings on karma are consistent that you never know when that will happen. It might happen like in 1 or 2 seconds, like when you turn to your spouse and you say, why did you do that? And you get karma real quick sometimes. But on the other hand, you may plant a seed according to the system and it may sprout in 2 seconds, 4 hours, 500 years, or 67 million kalpas. You have no idea. But what it says is it always matters. There is no moment of intentional action that a sentient being does that doesn't plant a seed that will bear fruit at some point for a sentient being. I'm completely dodging the question of the fact that they claim that that sentient being is a reborn form of you, because it doesn't matter. Who is it? If they have no memory of you, why does it matter that it's you? It's somebody. Somebody will receive the impact of the action. So, you know, in simple terms, it's like, it doesn't seem that complicated to know that if you keep saying every time you hear a particular voice on the radio, do people listen to radios anymore? Every time you hear that voice, you get mad. I remember there was a particular human being several years ago, and I hear that voice, I get mad. And I was like, oh. At some point, I was like, I don't like being mad. I don't like being mad. It's painful. It's an uncomfortable experience. Every time I did that, just planted seeds, reinforce. And at some point, I said, I'm going to do something else. So I just, I'm a recovering addict guy. So what we do is we pray for people we don't like. I just prayed for that person every day for eternity. And now I'm not mad. When I hear them, no, I'm not mad. So I planted different seeds. We have a choice. But whether you know you're planting the seeds or not, you're planting the seeds. This is why we're so invited to come to this moment, to see that how we're bringing ourselves to this matters. So we don't just unconsciously keep doing the same things. Look around at the world. There's a lot of patterning that is not helping people. So, everything is imaginary nature. Sounds good. everything is dependent nature. So, dependent nature. You know, this is pretty basic Buddhism, right? Each thing, you know, because of this, there is that, we say. So there's kind of complex ways to describe the pattern of dependency. Clearly, in early Buddhist teachings on dependency, though, the mind and karmic action is fundamental to what makes it appear like there are things. The 12-fold chain of dependent origination is largely, many of the components are mental or emotional or volitional. That's what it makes it seem like, something comes into being and something goes away. So this is, although this is like Yogacara teachings, everything that Yogacarans want to do, they want to say, we can clearly point to the origins in earlier canonical Buddhist literature and say it's, we're not just making stuff up. I don't know why they had to do that, because making stuff up is great, because things are an imaginary nature. You're imagining a world. Let's make something new up. I'm not into just doing the same old thing. Anyway, that was a digression. It's definitely not in the notes. So, a couple of implications of the dependent nature within the Yogacara tradition I'll talk about is, you know, everything is collective because everything is dependent, and that web of dependency is unlimited. So if you just kind of look at it, you go, well, this is dependent on that and that and that, but each one of those things was dependent on all the other things. It starts to just, the frame gets very big, right? It gets very big. So it's quite common, I think, that people get a sense of the dependent nature. You know, we can develop a sense of dependent nature in the kind of Thich Nhat Hanh style or the Yogacara style of conceptualizing interdependence by just thinking about all the things something depends on. So like, you know, what does it take for me to have a piece of toast this morning? Well, my mom had to bake the bread. Thank you, Mom. Oh, she had to give birth. We could go for a long time, right? So I'm not, you get the idea. The list is vast beyond comprehension. But although that's one method to get a sense of the dependent nature of things, my experience is that people frequently report, they wouldn't put it this in these terms that they're realizing dependent nature of things, but they are, because they come to our Zen center. And they say, oh, I came in the morning and I just sat for an hour. I didn't really know what I was doing. And then I went outside and I looked at a tree, and I felt like I'd never seen a tree in that way before, and I'd never been as close to a tree in my life. And it was really sweet. And it's very common that if we engage in zazen, so the conceptual activity of the mind that divides things up is softens, that what happens is we naturally have a sense of the connection that is here, the intimacy that's available. It's not even available. It's like how things are. So it can feel really good, very common. I don't know. I hope it's common. My sense is you do zazen, do a lot of Buddhist practices, and they enable you to feel more intimate and connected with what's here instead of alienated. You know what I mean? Like when you're really like super anxious or mad about something, or you really want something, and it's like, it feels like the world is like this big. It's like this little guy. It's a guy for me, but you know, whoever you are, talking to you, and you're like, oh, I'm in here waiting for that thing or scared about the thing. It's just, oh, so small. And it's like, I don't feel so connected to the ceiling or the people and so forth. And with practice, that gets quiet, and it's like, oh, a more spacious sense of intimacy, a dependency. We realize we depend on each other. So it can feel really good. I hear a lot of people talking about how this feels good because alienation is painful. but on the other hand, I will say realizing the dependent nature can also be pretty painful. I mean, if we look at a lot of Buddhist teachings, they say we want to realize that our life is dependent on death, for example. Buddha, arguably one of his earliest awakenings before he sat under the rose apple tree and found peace, was he saw people plowing the land, and he saw the insects and the worms that were being killed. So he realized that the sustenance of his life and the joy of the plowing ceremony that they were having was dependent on killing. It was very painful for him. This was important for his awakening, but it's quite common that realizing that we are intimate with systems that harm people is part of the path of liberation, but it's hard. So I do a lot of work around climate and racial justice, and it's painful for people to be like, oh, the climate change isn't like something a horrible other person is doing. It's something I am part of. I'm a part of this system. And, you know, it's oftentimes when talking about racial justice, a lot of people want to be like, the racism is like over there. So like I grew up in Iowa, and it was like, oh, racism, that was the thing they did in the South. Well, let's put it over there. And then I started to realize, oh, wait, I have racism right here in my high school in Iowa. And I come up here, and we're real great in Minnesota, but if you look at educational outcomes, pretty racist. So what does that mean? It means a system. Racism means a system that is inequitable based on race. And we definitely have that here. So, and then I want to be like, well, maybe it's the bad people doing it. It's, oh, can I keep bringing it closer into me so I realize I'm part of it? That's hard. I don't want to face it. And yet that's the ground on which I can, instead of objectifying people, blaming, I can realize I have agency and we have possibility. So it can be hard to face this. And in fact, just talking about this, there may be people who are like, I totally disagree, you're wrong, or I never want to listen to you again. It has happened before. And that's part of the process. That's actually the point. You know, likewise, in your family, you got family history problems. Do you want to look at those? I don't. But if we do, sometimes something really new can happen. Something really new, just even within the self. There's stuff going on in us. Look at, early Buddhist psychology makes room for that to be seen. Then we can plant some new seeds. So I'm going to read you a little passage here from this book. This one's shorter. That first reading is very long. Mm-hmm. We don't passively receive the reality of the world through our senses and then respond to it. The world we experience is created. It is, as the text says, the active cognition of seer and seen. Our life is created by karma, and we create karma in every moment. We have the power to plant seeds that will create a better world. This body of teaching emphasizes the impact of each moment of intentionality. Our power lies in the quality of heart and mind we offer to the moment. Why do I think this worldview is more effective than materialism for healing our suffering and freeing us from collective modes of violence, oppression, and destruction? I will answer with some lines from a Chinese Chan nun named Baoqi, who wrote, "The vastness of karmic consciousness is hard to prove, but when Mr. Zhang drinks, then Mr. Li gets drunk." Sometimes I get a call or I see an obituary telling me that another friend of mine has died from addiction. I've lost a dozen friends so far, and I can never know what part my enabling of their intoxication played, or the impacts their deaths and addictions will have on future generations of their families. The web is too complex to map with materialist tools. I can never know the impact of the thousands of hours I've spent working with addicts in recovery either. I have witnessed the awakening of so much freedom. One of Baoqi's inspirations, the great Chan Nun Miaozong, wrote, "When outside the diamond door he glowered, inside the stable the wooden horse's face turned red." In the verse above, there is no physical connection between the man's glower and the wooden horse's face, and yet there is reaction and connection. We cannot ultimately know when or where the results of any karmic seed will manifest, but manifest they will. Miaozong wrote her lines in a Chan compilation she created in the 12th century. But could she have known that in the 17th century, Baoqi and her Dharma sister Zukui, looking to revive the rarely recorded teachings of a female master of Chan, would pull them from obscurity and write their own commentaries, or that Beata Grant in the 21st century would again revive them in English? I believe that buying a chunk of an animal killed thousands of miles away, or offering a caring smile for a person on the street, as well as each tiny moment of anxiety, desire, or compassion you cultivate has an impact on every living being. I can't measure it. Miaozong says the wooden horse's face turns red. A wooden horse is a classic Buddhist metaphor for something that has no reality or causal agency, like the horns of a rabbit, a wooden man, or a stone woman. Miaozong invites us into a worldview of mystery where we don't know or see what is ultimately real, but where an angry glare causes suffering we can't calculate, where a smile has radiance beyond the limits of our knowing, where our actions really matter. All of this isn't real, but it's as real as it gets. So everything is of complete realized nature. Good news, everybody. Complete realized nature. What are we talking about here? What is the complete realized nature? It's what Buddhas see. And the seeing of the complete realized nature is what makes Buddha, Buddha. So Buddha means awake. And in one Yogacara wrote, teacher Dharmakirti wrote, "It is the naturally pure cognition of a sentient being that is indicated by the term Buddha." It is the naturally pure cognition of a sentient being that is indicated by the term Buddha. But everything's already of complete realized nature. The claim is that you can come to see it, but it's already true. Complete as in whole, unbroken, undamaged, realized as in realization, like what a Buddha is seeing. So these things are all three true. It's imaginary, it's dependent, and it's complete realized nature. It's not like you're going to go to the complete realized nature and then you left the imaginary behind. Because where would the rest of us be? That doesn't make sense. Look at the story of the Buddha's life. He's like, I have attained nirvana and I'm right here with you. What did he do? He spent his time with people, caring for them, meeting them however they were. So in talking about the complete realized nature, there is some tendency to talk about them in terms of what the complete realized nature, what we would usually think of as the self, and the complete realized nature, what we usually think of as other. So at the end of Vasubandhu's 30 verses on consciousness only, the last verse is, this is the inconceivable, wholesome, unstained, constant realm, the blissful body of liberation, the Dharma body of the great sage. This is the inconceivable, wholesome, unstained, constant realm, the blissful body of liberation, the Dharma body of the great sage. And what I really should start doing this is doing this like the hokey pokey where we all do the hand gestures together. So we realize I'm not saying like, oh yeah, I've got the Dharma body of the great sage. I'm saying this one, whatever one it is. And in that text, it's clear what he's saying. Having attained realization, this is what you realize. But if you read through the text, you also realize he's saying this is how it already is. This is how it already is. So that's fancy language. At the end of the Song of Zazen, Hakuin Zenji says the same thing. He paraphrases when he says, this very place is the lotus land, this very body, the Buddha. This very place is the lotus land, this very body, the Buddha. So why? Because all the things that you think are things that can harm you are not absolutely real. And it is possible to see through them. We see this happen. It doesn't mean that how we imagine things and the way we suffer are unimportant, because things are still of imaginary nature, but they're also not what we think they are. And we can begin to see all these sides of things. I want to read two very short passages from this book pertaining. Oh no, I got to say this. There's another person you may have heard of, a guy named Dogen Zenji. So he opens the Fukan Zazengi. He's saying this, I'm going to tell you why I think you should practice Zazen. And he uses the identical set of images. He says, the way is originally perfect and all-pervading. How could it be contingent on practice and realization? The true vehicle is self-sufficient. What need is there for special effort? Indeed, the whole body is free from dust. Who could believe in a means to brush it clean? It is never apart from this very place. What is the use of traveling around to practice? This place, this body, already completely realized, and that's why you should practice. That's why. Because if you're Buddha, in the Buddha land, what do Buddhas do? They practice. That's all the stories we have. They go around and they help people. So I'm going to read you these two short passages. First one relates to the complete realized nature of what we would conventionally understand to be the self. This is from a chapter called Already Buddha. When I came to Buddhist practice, I was seeking something else. I sought an escape from the anguish I experienced. My therapist told me it was the anguish of trauma from the past reproducing itself. My psychiatrist told me my brain didn't process serotonin properly. My addiction recovery friends called it defects of character, self-will, run riot. My Buddhist studies called it afflictive karma. All these ways of looking at it have their utility, and I am deeply grateful for all who have supported me in finding the wondrous, joyful existence of today. When we suffer, when we see the suffering of others, it is right to seek wellness, to seek something else. However, it is also true that there is not something else, that you and I are not and cannot be broken. For if there is brokenness, there must be a wholeness that is elsewhere. This is a duality, and duality is just a habit of mind. And this passage on the complete realized nature of where we are. Recently, I heard a talk by a Dakota elder named Bob Klanderud. He spoke of the total kinship of all life. He told us that the confluence of the Mississippi and Minnesota rivers near my home on U.S.-occupied Dakota land is called Bedote. For the Dakota, Bedote is the origin of the universe, the land of Genesis. In his words, it is Eden. He asked us, now that you know you live in Eden, how will you choose to live? Thank you, Bob Klanderud. And thank you, Vasubandhu. And thank you all for listening. I think now it's time for people, other voices. So I welcome, whatever you'd like to bring.
Can you apply the three natures of Vasubandhu to what is happening in Gaza right now?
Well, first, I'd just like to extend my heart to and encourage you to extend your heart to people of Israeli and Palestinian people, now people all over that region where war is spreading throughout many countries, and also to any people who are Jewish or of Palestinian descent, who are here in particular, who I found are much more directly impacted at the level of a heart by these conditions. So, recognizing that the way I view and the way each of us views the conflict in Israel and Palestine matters. The way we view it matters. That recognizing its imaginary nature, because we are imagining it in that way. And Buddhism invites us to view things in a way that is compassionate, that is engaged. And so it gives us an opportunity to consider, like, how can we expand the frame of our compassion to include everyone in the situation? It's kind of a big question, and there'll probably be more questions, so I'm going to go through with some expediency. We could probably spend, a lifetime. People do spend a lifetime on this issue. The dependent nature, it's pretty clear that the conditions for the people in Gaza and in that whole region are part of a vast web of conditions, really complex ones that include, we recently at MZMC, we had a gathering to really talk about how anti-Semitism, racism, Islamophobia impact the way these conditions are viewed in the United States, because those are part of it, but they're also much more complex. So realizing that there are hundreds, thousands of years of history, and that's just the beginning of it, that create those conditions. So realizing that because it's a complex web, trying to control things is probably not going to help, but trying to make an offering of something compassionate and kind is worth doing. And so how could you possibly say this is of complete realized nature? That's a question that arises for me. How can I even make that claim? It's hard for me to make that claim because it's unimaginable the amount of suffering, all these children being killed, people displaced. So how do I make that claim? I make it based on the fact that throughout history, there have been people in situations of unbelievable, staggering conflict who have manifested peace and said they were whole and complete. The Buddha's time was not one without war. When the great teachers like Shuto and Matsu were helping found the lineages of Buddhism we have right now, it's a massive warfare in China. And yet they were like, realization is here. I'm meeting people with the possibility of peace. You see people like the Dalai Lama I mean, we think Dalai Lama, I watch videos, oh, he's kind of a funny guy. He's an exile from his country. His country was invaded by a foreign power, culturally devastated. Most of the people he's with live in exile. And he's like, that's all true. I'm still working for justice and I'm happy. And I'm claiming, he will claim things are of complete realized nature. Thich Nhat Hanh, very similar. He brought this message. He brought this message to me into this room right now, exiled from his country during a brutal war prosecuted by the United States. So these are the reasons I think it's reasonable to claim, because people actually do it and realize it and manifest and keep working for peace, justice, and compassion. I usually preface the question section by saying, if you have a question like, could you talk about the distinctions between dependency as understood in the Pali Canon, Yogacara tradition, and the Madhyamaka tradition? Or if you have a question like, my uncle is really annoying, what should I do? Those kind of questions are both welcome. And also this kind of question is welcome. Not because like I have all the answers, but because all those things are welcome. There's room for all of it. I think we can hold them all. Or maybe you have comments, which is fine too. Love to hear other voices. Go ahead.
I guess, Dan, I don't have a question, but I just want to thank you for inviting people to be intellectual, because there's a, you know, it's just like Minnesota tends to have a cold northwest wind. This whole country has a cold wind against intellectual life.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you're asking people to read a difficult intellectual book instead of a crime novel, or turning on some kind of streaming TV, which will numb them. You're asking them to think about important things and to use their brain, which maybe they haven't used since college or something. So, maybe nobody, did you say people don't like you to talk about philosophy because it bores them? Yeah. I took about 7 philosophy courses, and I guess that's what led me to Zen. But anyhow, so I appreciate the effort you're making. It's kind of an uphill battle that, and I know you do a lot of work too on racial justice. So, people don't want to be reminded. I know you brought a speaker to MZMC that talked about what happened to the Japanese in this country. I think you brought that speaker. She was on. But people don't want to hear about. So anyhow, you take on uphill battles in your talk. And I think Americans really need that, to be pushed to get the thinking part of their brain going. And of course, Zen centers in general are trying to get people thinking, but you take on some heavy lifting. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Roger. Thank you. Yeah, sometimes it seems heavy, but I don't know. My practice is relational. So my experience of it is not generally of heaviness, but of the joyfulness of being with people engaged in liberation in lots of different ways. And I just want to say, like, one of the weirdest things about this is very intellectual. So, like, this book is a commentary on 38 verses on the Treatise on Three Natures by Vasubandhu. It's intensely, densely intellectual. And what it's pointing to is that all that thinking does not tell us the truth. So the appeal of this is for people who want a logical explanation for why your Zen teacher keeps telling you to just pick up your chopsticks with your whole heart, to just you know, choose the flower that you're putting in the vase. I came in this morning. These are just amazing. You know, the attention to cleaning the floor. I come into this space. It's so beautiful here. It's not magic. Well, of course it's magic, but you're doing it and I get to come into it. This provides a rational explanation for those of us who need it for why that's what we're doing. So yeah, thank you. Thank you, Roger. Other voices.
I'm kind of relatively new to studying Buddhism. I've been practicing yoga and meditation for quite a while. So the lens that I'm listening through and looking through as you were talking about the dependent nature, that what I found interesting was as I think about dependence or dependent on depending, it seems to be often interpreted as such a linear path, but the way that you presented it was the complete antithesis of that, making it so much more broad in how things are dependent on another or one another or history or a path. It's not so straight and narrow. It was just very enlightening for me to hear that definition or explanation being so much more vast, I guess, is maybe the word. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. And, you know, early Buddhism, it's a kind of a forward-looking linear development. So 12-fold chain appears to kind of look like time going this way. And then Yogacara does some things that start to make that look soft. And then I'm kind of cheating by sneaking in some what I will Huayan, which is my next book, Buddhism, where they really just explode time and they use all the same logical methods, but just make little twists and tweaks and look at different implications to show that time actually goes in all directions. And then we see that in Dogen's view, time and space, all directions. So we can just feel more completely connected, which is, I think, practically speaking, what the point is. Thank you. Yeah.
I just want to make a comment. It seemed like your closing comments were so profound to me, and it seemed like what you were saying is nothing is everything and everything is nothing, you know, basically. Just this, again, the sense of everything being so broad. And anyway, it's so you're explaining it intellectually in order that we see it and feel it at the same time. And then I'm thinking about your comment too. And about intellectualism, and I'm thinking, but I'm also feeling. And there's some sort of magical duality in that, and not thinking. And I appreciate what you're saying, but I also appreciate non-intellectualism in and of itself. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's room for all of it. You know, a Yogacara, one of the implications is that each person in every moment can only enact and experience realization in the particular way that their conditions create. So we're all different. We can all grow in different ways. Yeah.
Right. And so we're here to, because we're human and we appreciate our infinite possibilities in the dependence, I guess, in the experiences, mm-hmm. Not the dependence, the experiences.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sounds about right. Thank you. Yeah. Yeah, go ahead. I think probably I'll wrap up after this one.
Yeah, thank you so much for all of that. I would say I'm also pretty new to studying Buddhism, and I appreciate some of the stuff you illuminated specifically. When I think of perspectives, I kind of always thought that the perspective on perspective is they're just consciousness. They're no different than the rock behind you or anything else. And sort of it doesn't really matter. And kind of the lesson what I was hearing was like, no, it does matter. It is connected. And I'm love philosophy, but I'm also a very pragmatic person. And I'm kind of curious, when you have perspectives in your life and you're like, that's not the seed I want to sow, like, how do you work with that sort of? And you kind of commented like, oh, I was angry at this person. I prayed for this person. But like, when we're talking about things that are not maybe just a person, but a philosophy in itself or something else that you're grappling with, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. So yeah, our perspective matters because that's what we got. You know, that's what causes us to be, causes us to suffer, causes us to act, or that's what we act on. But yeah, there's so many, I think there's just a lot of ways to let go of things. I mean, a great way is to just come in here and sit down and do like just about nothing in this zendo and just let the, sounds and the body and the sights, you know, they do their thing. Because then the part of the mind that's creating the perspectives is you're not doing something to it. It's not more control. It just tends to be less dominating. And so perspectives, those kind of perspectives that are dominating our view, they tend to be less dominating. So that's a really good way. But it's, you know, also just, you know, I'll have stuff come out of my mouth. You know, I'll be like, whoa, whoa, whoa. And then I'll be like, wait a minute. And then I'll just stop and be like, well, that was wrong. I'll give you one example. I think I can make this example before I go. I was giving a talk at All Being Zendo in Washington, D.C. And I said, you know, I was talking about something. And in that context, I said, you know, well, I never had a Japanese teacher. And then I said, I had a Japanese teacher. My sewing teacher was Tomoe Katagiri. I studied with her for 4 years. My ingrained patriarchal views and the patriarchal views of this tradition give me the perspective that even though I had a Japanese teacher for 4 years, in the middle of this talk, I said I'd never had a Japanese teacher. So that was a moment where something came out of my mouth and I just stopped and went, wait a minute. And I just replaced it with something more true, which is I had a Japanese teacher. And then I got to talk about Tomoe for a while because she was amazing. She was an amazing teacher. She brought the sewing of Soto Zen robes to the United States through Eshin Yoshida. And she imparted something so beautiful to me, which is the ability to just sit and do a simple stitch after stitch with my whole heart. In the context of the vow to liberate all beings from suffering. So there's a lot of other ways. So good question. Anyway, really nice to be with you all. This is just a really sweet opportunity and an honor. And thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.